I want to make sure whatever I leave out there now is more going to leave more of a legacy and an impression on people than just that temporary laughter. I want to make sure that people know that when I put stuff out there, it's profound. It's going to give them some lessons. And I just want to be an example that, so when I hear people say, man, I don't know what to do with myself. I got passed up for this promotion. I'm like, oh, that sucks. It does suck. Hey, but by the way, when my dad died and my mom died and this happened, I came out of it. And so if I can go through that, so can you. The point of all that is now that I'm starting to put that stuff out there is if I can get through what I went through and still be in the position that I'm in now. And you know, in the foreseeable future, I think I'm going to still continue in this success, that you can too.
Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, 2023 at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center. It's going to be a great experience. 5 career-changing days, some of the most profound speakers in the industry. Guest speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Navy SEAL American war hero Jason Redman, Sheriff David Clark, Sheriff Mark Lamb, and Sheriff Wayne Ivey. You'll also spend time with all of our Street Cop instructors at this event Monday through Friday. We'll have a great lineup of courses in addition to our great speakers. It will be a week that you will not forget. You'll be thankful you came. You don't want to miss out. Check out streetcop.com on how to register. If you're going to use the room code, make sure you book it from Sunday through Friday. That's what the code's good for, and it's about half the price of the regular rate. But those rooms are running out, so make sure you sign up now. We'll see you there. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and I have with me today a man you might know from Instagram, 9/11 Strong, right?
Yeah. People call me that all the time.
People call you 9/11 Strong?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why. In the beginning of the whole social media thing, they're all, hey, 9/11 Strong, you know, I recognize you from Instagram or whatnot. I get that every once in a while. And I'm like, oh, cool. Then I'll introduce myself. I'm like, hey, Aram, it's Aram. So it's kind of a nice icebreaker when they don't know your first name. But I guess nowadays when you follow somebody, you can actually see their real name. So maybe more people will recognize me by Aram. But
well, you've got a unique look to you too, right? So it's much people see you, they know exactly who you are.
Yeah, you know, what's funny was growing up, I always heard, you look like all the other Asian guys I know. You all look the same. And today, I don't know, I guess it's rare to be a bald Asian guy. And
in law enforcement, it's not like law enforcement agencies are loaded with Asian dudes.
Yeah, you know, growing up, that was the case. When I started my career in 99, I had 2 Asian guys in my academy class, and I was one of them. And we had 120 people. And in Southern California, yeah, it was very rare to see Asian people. But fast forward in 2022, going into 2023 now, in Southern California, they made such a push to hire people that fit the demographics of the cities, certain municipalities that have a high Asian population. And now you're starting to see more. So that's a lot of where my followership comes from, too, is a lot of Asian people that are in law enforcement that kind of look to me as their role model or something, so to speak. And because you're right, there is none. I can't think of a single social media cop right now that puts himself out there that's Asian besides me. So yeah, it's kind of a cool thing to be Asian in law enforcement and kind of be on the downslide of my career and be able to mentor these young people coming up. But yeah, I grew up, you know, I'm third generation American, and being Asian really wasn't, I didn't really know I was Asian until high school, believe it or not. You know, all my friends were all a mixed bag. My best friends in junior high are my best friends today. And, race was never an issue until I became closer to my adult years.
I just want to make this statement. I've been around a while, 21 plus years in this profession. I have never met an Asian cop I didn't like.
All right.
I'm not. Yeah. Like that's, I know quite a few of them too, dude. I mean, we're in Jersey, right? A lot of Asian, big yeah. Asian population. Actually, where I worked was next to a town that is basically known in this state for being extremely Asian. So a lot of my friends, the next town over, they're cops that speak Chinese and Korean and, you know, every dialect of Cantonese, whatever. I don't want to start. I'm trying to be honest, but it might start bordering like I'm like on the border of like sounding a racist piece of shit. But yeah, I love them all, dude. I like literally some of my favorite people in the world. Some of the nicest guys too.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You're worrying about stepping on thin ice and stuff, but I think that's what attracts me to this career. You know, you've got to have thick skin to be in this career. And if, and, you know, we run across people on this job that have thin skin and they usually don't last or they're not liked. And the thing is, it doesn't matter what our backgrounds are, where we come from. You know, I worked with a guy who's a millionaire. He was an heir to the Timken ball bearing company that started out on the East Coast in Ohio, but he grew up a millionaire. He didn't have to be a cop. But he grew up with an unpalatable taste to the people he was coming up with. Right. He said they were spoiled. They were entitled. He didn't want to carry a briefcase for the rest of his life. He tried to join LAPD. They told him he was crazy. He's overqualified. He tried to join another large municipality. They said no. He tried the FBI. They said no. And this guy has a Harvard MBA. He's got political connections. His dad was the ambassador to Germany under Bush, Bush Jr. So he started applying everywhere. Our department hired him as a volunteer. They said, hey, you know, there are reasons why we don't want to hire you full time. This is weird. But you prove yourself as a volunteer, we'll hire you as a reserve and we'll see how it goes from there. He ended up enjoying a 20-year career. He retired a few years ago from us and now he works for the feds. But I mean, you come across people from all walks of life and you would never know this guy was rich unless you went to his house or whatever. And I mean, he was so tight too. Like we'd go out to eat, he'd never pick up the tab. And it's like this guy out of all the guys that had the ability to, it'd be him. But that's why I love this career. I mean, without getting too detailed, the locker room chatter, the conversations that happened inside the unit. I mean, there's really no line that can't be crossed in there and no one's really going to get offended. But
Asian guys are the best, like, because they are so self-deprecating with their humor.
Yeah.
Every Asian dude I know has like the best Asian jokes in the world. And it's like, dude, I sound like they're just, there's a comfort level with me and Asian cops. I don't know what it is. It's like, I don't have to worry about a fucking thing. And I got to be honest with you. I'll say it for all cops. I mean, I have friends, you know, that across the landscape, color, creed, religion, age, everybody for the most part has a pretty good sense of humor. Then of course, there's a, like you said earlier, with that one person who you got to watch what you say around Mary or fucking John or whoever, or they take things pretty seriously.
Yeah. But you know what we're hitting a pretty good percentage. You know, I think if you throw it out there in the career, there's a pretty good chance it's going to be responded well. You go to training classes, for instance, I'm sure your classes are filled with people from different agencies that don't know each other, but halfway through the class, they're all cracking jokes. So that's, you don't see that in any other profession.
No. And to be honest with you, I'm usually leading the charge and orchestrating the dark humor,
yeah,
which sometimes is detrimental to my progression. But I think it also at the same time gets people to really understand that I'm one of you. I'm one of the fucking dudes. I'm a brother to both men and women in this profession. And you can relax in here. We're in good standing and nobody is off the table for being criticized and ridiculed in class. And I don't make people feel bad. We just goof around a lot and tell fucking crazy shit. But
yeah, I think it's funny when you start your career, everybody's a sir or a ma'am to you, right? And after you get to a certain comfort level, nothing's changed. Sergeants are still sergeants, lieutenants are still lieutenants or whatever. But all of a sudden they become Jim or Steve or Bob. They don't become sir anymore. And I think, you know, being on the receiving end of that, I like that. That's more comfortable to me. It's never been comfortable for me to, I feel like it's sterile or impersonal when someone calls you sir or by your title. It's like, and believe it or not, there are some agencies where guys expect that. So that culture is toxic in my opinion. I stay away from that. I belong to a really nice, you know, culture at my agency. And it's a really unique situation where we're at. And I've had a blessed career because of it.
There are probably people listening to this going, what's the agency that he's talking about? Because I want to apply there.
Yeah. Well, we are hired.
To say it.
I'm public with it. I work for the El Monte Police Department. We're about 130 right now. We need to be at 150. We're about 12 miles outside of downtown Los Angeles. So people consider us LA. I started my career with a very large agency. I was with the LA County Sheriff's Department. I was there 5 years and I ended up getting married while I was a deputy. And we were talking about settling down and you know, putting our roots down. But in such a big county with such a big territory, they can put you anywhere. And we didn't want that in our lives. We wanted to be grounded in the community. So I ended up jumping ship and joining a department where two of my other buddies jumped ship also. they were the friends I was talking about, my best friend since junior high. We all wanted to be part of the same department, but when we learned their chances of working together were slim and being successful, they jumped ship. And so I joined them. I ended up following them. We worked together for the last 18 years at the same department. Unfortunately, one of those guys just passed away in October. He lost his battle to cancer, but he elevated all the way to chief. He probably was the acting chief for 6 months before they gave him the job. When they gave him the job, it was kind of a rough time for us at our agency. It was June 14th. We lost two officers during an OIS. And one of them was a good buddy of mine, and one of them was new. He only had a year on the job. It was a trying time. We've lost officers before in the past, but it had been years. And then this was the first time in our history we lost two in one incident. And I got to see Ben really step up. A lot of people didn't know he was battling cancer at the time and really going through some personal struggles. He was about to take time off, because that morning when the shooting happened, Ben got the phone call. He was in the doctor's office getting the news that he had terminal cancer. Jesus. And he told his doctor, believe it or not, that's not the worst news I've heard today. And, you know, obviously he had a heart for his troops, and that's just the kind of guy he was. And that's just the kind of department we have. That culture is still there. So if anybody's listening in Southern California and they want a job at a place that is really the best kept secret in law enforcement, I mean, everybody out in our area thinks about LAPD and sheriffs, but when you think about agencies that are so politically connected, it just breeds a toxic environment. Everybody's micromanaging, everybody's looking out for their best interests. Whereas I really belong to a department that's family focused, it's team focused. You know, I'm in charge of a unit that has 20 people in it. And if guys need to take time off to be at their son's ball game or daughter's swim meet or whatever, that's priority. We preach family first. So, yeah, that's my recruiting spiel for hiring.
Well, if you really want to find some real hard charges for your agency, I have a class in Escondido.
Escondido, yeah.
I know. You come to it, bro.
Yeah, maybe I will. When is it?
It's a one-day program. Hold on, let me look at my website. I don't have my calendar in front of me. You check my website here, dude. It's a good program. You're going to really enjoy yourself. You're not going to be like, what am I doing here? You're going to be thankful that you came, and it'd be cool to have you. And if you want to, you know, bring some folks, but yeah, really good opportunity there to recruit maybe some decent talent, because the people who come to our training courses are usually self-motivated. They're the hard chargers, the people who are more passionate about this job. And, you know, that really narrows the pool down, because I'm sure you guys want quality people. You know who's not coming to my training? The bum who hates the job, right, who only does it to work off duty at the, you know what I mean? Like, those guys aren't in my training. Right. Do they trickle in sometimes? Yeah, what happens? They send some of their best personnel to training. They come out. These guys are 10Xing their production, their knowledge level, their everything's improved. And they go, oh, well, if that worked for Tim, Joe, and Susan, it's got to work for Pete as well. And, you know, the bottom line is I'm not Jesus.
Right.
I can't take your worst cop and make him or her great. But I will say this, even those men and women who show up who don't want to be there often are like, yo, this is really good. I really enjoyed this today. I'm like, thank you. You know what, dude, honestly, even if at a very minimum, they get something out of the class of like, hey, I did something that I didn't know I shouldn't be doing, and now I'm not going to do it anymore. And I didn't die because something you showed me that I didn't know we were doing, it was so fucking stupid. That's good enough for me, man. I'm not here to, like, all are welcome, right? I want everybody to at least hear the perspective of how we see law enforcement. Sure. Let me see my upcoming classes here.
Yeah,
on my website.
As you're looking for that, I'll just fill in the dead air there. That's probably going to happen when you look that up. But it's kind of one of those things today that it's the information's available. It's on. If you go to your page, you see hundreds of clips and reels of training. Even though that's free and accessible in the palm of their hand, there are people that are reluctant to do that. The people that go to the academy, they finish the academy. That's all the training they'll ever receive throughout their career. Those are the people that we don't want. We want people that are going to constantly develop, self-motivated, like you said, the people that know that they're going to be career lifelong learners. Like, if you don't understand that about yourself, then we probably don't want you. If you're one of those guys that thinks you have it all figured out, you're just going to be a liability for our agency.
For me, I'm just like, man, I'm constantly trying to. I was actually thinking about this on the way in, and when I say these things, people probably think I'm out of my mind, but I have like 1,000 thoughts a minute. So on the way in, I was like, It's so interesting. Some of the people that I worked with, I was thinking about some of the work that they did and some of the acknowledgement they got for some of the work that they did, which now looking at it, I'm like, it was kind of bullshit work, to be honest with you. In the grand scheme of things, it was a little bit of a bullshit work and they were impressing people on some bullshit. So, you know, people have to understand to be your best is to try to reach your maximum potential.
Right.
You don't have to be the best cop there is. You don't have to understand body language and looking at a car like some of our people and see a trap in plain sight. What you can say if you're doing a good job is I'm doing the best that I can. I'm trying to continue to develop to the best of my potential. Like a guy like me, right? I'm trying to understand, can I grow a company to be a 9-figure company? It's a very hard thing to do. And a pill to swallow there is, I might not have the skill set to pull that off. It's very difficult. I'm happy with the progression of this, but I also recognize like I'm going to keep trying. And if at the end they go, you built it to 8 figures, this is where you guys landed. You couldn't push it past that. All I can say is I tried my best with what I had. You know, it's
Well, that's very telling about what kind of guy you are. I mean, this is the first time we've actually had a conversation, but I could probably make some assumptions about you. You were probably in leadership positions almost your entire life. Did you play sports growing up or in school?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I mean, I was. I went to 3 police academies. Even my first one, I wasn't the right guy for the executive officer position. So it was a CO and an XO for that class because I was 19, right? But they realized that like I was fucking all in. Right. And I think I got it on the fact that like they knew that I was there. And I wasn't the hand job in the academy. I wasn't the guy's like, let's make sure everything's perfect. I'm like, you know, just like, yo, I got your fucking bag, bro. Don't worry about it. I know you're not feeling well. I'll carry your shit today. Right. I was one of those guys. Like so I got it there. And you know, I ever have chevrons or bars or no, I didn't, but believe me, dude, I've said this before and I'll say it again. There was a good portion. I don't think anybody that I worked with wouldn't follow me somewhere.
Right. And that's a good point that you bring up. You don't need to have the title or the insignias to be a leader. And I preach that with my guys. It's like you're out there, you're already a leader. You're a community relations officer. You're a representative of the agency. You're a PIO. Yeah. And you know, you talk to other officers, you might be the recruiter that day. The thing is, you're the position that you're in. I don't care about the title because we all know we've worked with people that have the title that have no business being in leadership. And you know, the people that are reluctantly put in those positions are the ones that I admire the most. But you know, we talk about self-motivating people. I can tell by looking at you and just having a brief conversation with you, your brain kind of works like mine. I have a long commute. I have an hour and a half commute to work. And during that time is when I come up with some of my best ideas, right? And it's one of those things to have ideas, but it's another thing to execute them. And you're an example of someone that's taken one of their many ideas and actually executed it into something successful. So good on you, man.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you, man. And don't discount yourself. I mean, you have a significant following. I don't know what your business side of how you're procuring revenue outside of being a cop is, but I can tell you this. I know my fucking blue line flag's better than yours. I'm just saying that.
Right now. It's very, very impressive. Let me angle mine up. You know, mine's not bad. You know,
like yours is decent. You know what I mean, at best.
This is in my office, and I've got them strewn all over. I've been blessed. Talk about revenue. We'll just talk about some of the free things I get. This is this one right here. So it turns out one of my followers lives in the city I work in. Let me see if I can get a good look at it right there. And a city I live in. And he saw me with my family at a coffee shop one day and he says, hey, will you look for my message? I'm going to message you. I said, yeah, absolutely. Really nice guy. He ended up moving to Virginia because he hates California. But before he left, he made it for me. I mean, and I said, what do I owe you? And he said, no, I want you to have this. I said, let me shout you out. I don't even have a business page. I do this as a hobby. And if you look around my office, it's full of boxes and stuff I haven't even opened yet. But that's the cool stuff. Revenue, yeah, there's an opportunity. If anybody's listening that wants to be a presence in social media, I'll tell you one thing. It's going to get you attention at work, negative or positive, you're going to lose your privacy. You're not, you know, whatever you think you're going to put out there, if you want to be that person. If you have a meme page or whatever, that's different. But if you're going to be that person that's going to be the face of your growing page, you're going to lose some privacy. People are going to Google you. People are going to be curious about you. They're going to find your address. So be a part, you know, hopefully you're in a state where they have laws in place where they can remove your personal information from the internet. California is one of them. I think there's 13 states that allow that, do all that, because you're gonna get some weird stuff in the mail. You're gonna get some weird stuff at work. And I don't care how big you are, because this was all happening at every stage. And mine was a steady progressional growth. But yeah, there's opportunities to make money. I just started making money on Instagram Reels last year. I think that's when the first time they offered it to me. Facebook, I've been making money all along. People trip. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a bag of stuff there, some memes, police-related stuff, non-police-related stuff. And the reason is because it grew. It's almost at 200,000. I hired an agency to run that page because they do a good job of posting stuff on my behalf. And the way Facebook works, even though Instagram and Facebook are the same company, they work very differently. You post a meme and that meme gets shared, 100 times, that's money in my pocket. So this agency does a good job of procuring memes, creating memes, posting it. And that's a side thing for me. So this is all passive income. And, you know, I know this isn't a business show topic, but
dude, listen, we go into fucking business talks all the time, but see, now you get into MySpace.
Well, I'm telling you, man, all the young cops, I tell them, max out your 457, get some real estate, whether you want to live in it or not, and then find some passive income. So for me, social media is a passive income. I have real estate. I got 4 properties, and I teach on the side. So I was never an academic. If you looked at me in high school, someone that barely graduated high school, and you see me now as an adjunct professor at a private Division I university here in Southern California, I'm like, what happened to this guy? Well, I just got it. You know, school isn't the right time for everybody. I didn't go to college right after high school, and I did, but I dropped out. For me, college wasn't important to me until after I had a family and I realized, hey, I need to do well in this job and keep moving so that I can secure a good salary and good retirement. So, and in my area, you needed to have a degree to promote. So I got that. And once I got my degree, I did well. I got the bug. I said, I'll just go to the next level. And I worked up to get my master's. So I have 4 or 5 different streams of side income other than my priority, my real job, my police job. And, you know, that's given me a really comfortable life. I live in a really nice house. I live in a nice community. And, you know, all this from a job that just requires a high school diploma. It's amazing. You guys have compressed schedules at where you are?
When you say compressed schedule, what does that mean?
312, 410. Yeah. Yep. So if you're from one of those agencies, you got 3 or 4 days on your days off to do side hustles. And I'm not talking about picking up that security job. I mean, those are great too, but I'm talking about meaningful passive income that you can develop. You guys are, you know, people that are listening, if you're in this job, you're a creative person to begin with. Think outside the box, use some of those ideas that you come up with and actually execute, put pen to paper and get it done.
Just make sure you get permission from your agency first, because they'll you know how the game is. You are owned while you work for them. They own you.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you guys have the Peace Officers Bill of Rights there. So
we're pretty protected in Jersey, you know, but yeah. Some states aren't, dude. You know what I mean? Oh, some states, yeah.
It's crazy. Like California being as liberal as it is, they have a great set of protections for cops. We have POBAR, the Peace Officers Bill of Rights. We also have, because it's a liberal state, we have, you know, it's pretty much union run. And that's not different from the police here. We have unions. We have bargaining committees, and we have our police unions. And because of that, we've negotiated some fantastic benefits and retirements. But you move over one state to like Arizona, for instance, you max out after 20 years. Any supplemental retirement that you have comes out of your pocket. There is no Peace Officer's Bill of Rights. So if you have discipline, yeah, they can just yank your or revoke your post and then you're done. But yeah, I mean, we just passed Senate Bill 2 a couple of years ago, which takes an effect in January 2023, which makes us now certified and decertified eligible. So they can yank your certification. And I thought, man, really, we're starting to go backwards. But I just found out California is one of the last states in the country to actually put into law the ability to decertify cops. So, you know, say what you will about California. It's politics suck, but it's a good place to live if you're a cop in an agency that supports you. If you're in a high profile agency, good luck. You're going to have a really difficult career. But yeah, I mean, I encourage people to go to smaller agencies where they value the officer because they know it's harder to get and attract officers. So they're going to give you like an outstanding benefit and pay package. And they're going to nurture you while you're here because they have to develop you from the, you know, they got to develop their leadership from the inside. They don't want to bring in outside people. I think I saw a post you recently made talking about that, that fact.
Listen, man, again, a lot of some of my stuff is not really, people get very confused on my position regarding administrations. I am so pro good administration that I will be the biggest fucking advocate. And nobody is selling more to prove that they are pro law enforcement in the state of Florida. I can't tell you how many messages I get a day, or people I know from New Jersey, where we make way into the six figures. I
mean, oh yeah,
you got agencies here making, I mean, you got patrolmen doing 165 a year as patrolmen, right? Who are like, yeah, I'm going to Florida to make 71. And I'm like, I'm what? That's how good of a job they're doing in Florida, saying, come here, we will support you. It actually proves my theory of when people are law enforcement officers, it's not the money, right? That's a added benefit if you actually stumble upon a place that is, it's the culture and the appreciation for them and the support for the administration that most people are looking for. So what happens at these, and I will actually, I try to make this as direct as possible. If you work for a large scale, metropolitan, liberally ran city as a police officer, you're insane.
Yeah.
That's just me. I get it. You know, the people need us. I'm with all that stuff, right? But you're a human being and you deserve at a very minimum to be seen, validated and heard and be treated with respect. I also, when you said a, you know, a smaller agency, I agree that compared to the NYPD or Philadelphia Police Department, you might find a smaller agency in comparison to those. But when people always ask me, what do I look for in a good agency? My suggestion is not to ask the recruiting person, what's it like here? Or just one or two people. I think you should poll many people.
Sure.
And see if there's a collective overall theme. What I know is that agencies where things are good, even the people who are miserable are like, yeah, it's not that bad here, right? Even the miserable fucks, everybody else is like, dude, it's great. They give us everything. Like we're told and encouraged to be proactive. They're good with us. Like, you know, they'll hold you accountable, but like they also understand mistakes and like, dude, we're pursuit rated and they fucking let us pursue and like getting promoted here is good. So, you know, you got to be careful who you're hearing it from. You might hear from the one piece of shit, miserable bastard who's there and saying like, fuck this place. Yeah, because, you know, he's not acknowledging or she's not acknowledging or taking responsibility for their actions and they're blaming it on everybody else.
Yeah.
That's why you ask five or six people. Now, a few things you got to look for. How does everybody feel about the administration and do they encourage proactivity? If you find a place that, and I don't mean proactivity, you're going out and you're going to hammer out tickets and they want you to run random plates. I'm talking about they want you going out and putting handcuffs on bad guys. Whether or not you have this skill to determine whether a bad guy is a low-level bad guy or a high-level bad guy, the bottom line is if they encourage you to go out and do your job with full admin support, this is a clear indication of an agency that you want to apply for. You hear other shit, right? Like, well, they're not really into that. Yeah. You know, they only really want you answering your radio here. The problem with that is that's something called, and I'll make this term up right impromptu at this moment. Agencies who are trying to limit liability by trying to convince you to do less, because in their mind, for them, their own personal selves, less traffic stops, less liability. The problem is what they're not seeing on the other side of it. There's a double-edged sword there. When we're not intervening and letting people know that there is a threat of the police out here, if you're going to go commit crime, the victim side of things is where all the risk is. But again, they don't care. It's not their family. They don't live in town. So, you know, you got to understand that's what I tell people when we talk about looking for an agency. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to be reactive, like become one of those agencies that are transforming to reactive type agencies, you might as well be a firefighter, right? Because they respond, they don't do any active patrol or anything like that.
Right.
That's why we become cops. It's last I checked, it's a bad guy's job to run and our job to catch them. And if you can be part of an agency where your administration appreciates that because they're from the neighborhood, they're invested in the neighborhood. That's by the way, another thing to look for. The one unique thing about my agency that I've seen, and I you know, I travel the country with the Cannonball Memorial Run. I talk to a lot of agencies, is we're really unique in that we actually look for homegrown people or people that have a connection to the city where their family's here or they grew up here. They have friends that live here. If you're not invested in the city that you're working, then you're going to have just a little bit less of a connection. So if you can find that connection, and maybe it's a community of people that you like. And that's why I enjoy being a part of one agency and not having to bounce around from city to city. Because, you know, after being on the job at this city for 20 years, I know everybody here. I know all the players too. We had an extreme gang culture. When I first started here, we averaged about 35 murders a year. Wow. And less than 5 murders a year. And yeah, I'd like to say the PD took all the credit for that. We did a good job of gang suppression, but yeah, we basically eliminated 3 of the 4 big gangs we had in the city. We have one big gang now. We just did a RICO on them, and you know, they're pretty quiet right now. And you know, technology helps too. I mean, we're tracking guys. We have the cameras. What do they call them? Yeah. And it's helping us, you know, be more intelligent with how we approach our proactivity. But yeah, everything you said is absolutely true. I belong to an agency that encourages proactivity. We're probably one of the last agencies still in the department that promotes based on merit and gives people positions based on merit.
Right.
I went to a couple of years ago, I went to a training class, and I was talking to this husband and wife, and they were both miserable at the agency that they were at. And one of them ended up lateraling to another agency. And this guy, Frankie, I said, "Hey, why don't you come over here? A guy like you would probably be on, make the SWAT team in a couple of years, and you'll probably get into a specialized unit." And sure enough, his two year anniversary, he got put on the SWAT team, which is a collateral duty at our agency, and he's on our DEA task force. So it doesn't matter how much time on you have here, because, you know, I mean, time on is great. You develop some experience and stuff, but it's not a skill. I tell people that all the time. These salty guys that hang around and have done nothing for 20 years and think they can walk into a position, that means nothing to me. The guys I want are the guys that are motivated, and let me see what you've done in the short time that you're here. And those are the guys that actually have the most potential to develop anyway, because you're thinking about succession planning and whatnot. You want to develop these guys so that when they do go back out to patrol, which they eventually will, when they rotate out or get a promotion, now you just put a person that's enhanced down there, out there, that's going to be able to pass that information on to the people that haven't had a chance to go to specialized units yet. So yeah, there's a lot to say. I mean, the whole point of that was go to an agency where they appreciate proactivity, because it breeds a whole other culture that you won't see at some agencies that want you to be reactive as opposed to proactive.
An important thing to do is when you have a culture like that at your agency, is to preserve it. You know, recently, a friend of mine, he's a very well-liked chief here. I have a lot of friends that are chiefs here. Very well-liked chief. And, you know, he's leaving soon. I just talked to him on the phone. And I said, you know, did you line it up so it stays the way it is? He goes, yeah, we did. I made my recommendations. The next person up is very good. People are very happy. I said, yeah, okay. I actually did hear that next person's very good. Just, we don't want to allow, because, dude, it's over. Like, right, once you get that toxic, that horrible person in, it's over, right? And especially if you can't convince that toxic, horrible person. People say to me, oh, you know, you say these things and administrations hear this and they get upset. No, they don't. Not the ones that matter, right? The ones that we're not calling out. Like, I could tell you, I anything I can, you're a great police. I do free training. When I hear a chief is great, he's trying to change things, they'll reach out. Now, do not fucking do this to me. I am very busy. But in the past, they've said, like, hey, man, I took over. We're getting 3 canines on the road. We want to start doing this. We have like 25 guys. We'd like to get some training rolling. Can we host you? Yes, in turn, because I like who you are. I like what your mission is. I see it the same as me. The men and women need people like you. But yeah, I will come and do training with you guys just to support your cause. Where did you learn or develop your positions on how you feel and see things? Like, what makes you think the way you think? Is just collected data over the years? You reading leadership books? You tell me.
I'm not one of those leadership book guys. I hate reading books. I teach classes where I make students read books, and I feel like that's torture, because I hate reading myself. I'm not one of those guys that reads for pleasure. I tried doing the audiobook thing too. I can't, Aram,
I'm addicted to audiobooks. Like, it's like crack cocaine for me.
I need to find the right one, but I am going to download David Goggins' book.
The new one?
No, the old one. I've never read any of his books.
Yeah, so dude, Can't Hurt Me is good. I just finished it. Yeah, I'm late to the party. It came out in 2018, And his second book just got released. And it's a new, I don't know what it's called, but it's a new one. I'm proud to promote him. Good book. But I also say this, I get that, you know, you want to get into a book. People always ask me, hey, what's a book that you should recommend? Well, the question is, what are you looking for?
Yeah.
So maybe I can give you a book referral. If I have something in my locker of the 400 books I've read in 7 years, what do you think you're looking for most right now in your life?
I like when I learn new things, and that's it. I'm not one of those guys that, you know, I'm really impressed with David Goggins, and I'll do research all day long. I'll read on the internet, right? Cause I'm learning something. I'm one of those guys that likes to read articles, short term. Cause I think I might be one of those guys that has undiagnosed ADHD, right? But I'm a million miles a minute when it comes to things. So I lose, if there's like a lull in the book, I that's where you lost me. I need to be constantly like, that's why I like action movies or comedy movies. They're just always go, go, go. I can't get into like these, you know, some people binge watch shows and stuff, but you'll lose me as soon as there's an episode I'm not into, and I'm just on to the next thing. But yeah, anything I can learn from. So a lot of these books that break up small chapters, I'm into that. Cause I'm like, I'm not going to read that chapter. I'll move on to the next, and I'll read bullets of what I want. And that's just the kind of guy I am. Blunt, straight to the point. I'm not discourteous. I'm going to be very courteous to you as I deliver the message, like, hey, thank you, I'm not interested. But you know, when to your original question, my viewpoints are just my viewpoints because of the influences I had growing up. It was my grandfather, it was my dad, and my mom. They were all three of them were small business owners, and not that I saw them at the helm bringing up businesses. It was how they interacted with their employees. My mom's flower shop. Let me give you a little history. When my mom came to this country, she came to this country because she married my dad. My dad was stationed in Korea. They got married. I was born there. I was born on base, actually. And 6 months later, he got reassigned to Fort Lewis.
Is your father Korean too? That's interesting. So was he in the United States, went over as a Korean soldier, met a Korean woman in Korea?
Right. You know, he served during the Vietnam era, but towards the end when it was kind of, you know, it's between 74 and 70, I don't know when the conflict ended, 76, I want to say it was towards the end. And they're like, we're not going to send you there. We need to send you where we need you, which is Korean, because he spoke Korean. So they sent him to Seoul. And he was stationed in the base there. And so he met my mom, and, you know, my dad was an anomaly back then. There were a lot of, like, we had this conversation earlier about Asian being in law enforcement. Asian men were not in the military, and it was kind of an anomaly. My dad and both his brothers were in the army. And so my dad kind of stood out in the local community. He's like, man, there's this Korean guy that was from here, became American, and came back to serve. And so my mom is a really beautiful person, and they got married, and she was studying to be a florist. So she comes here and she meets some people, and she's like, I need a job. I want to become a florist. Where do I apply? And they're all, well, you need to look in the paper. So she looks in the paper. Her grasp of English isn't that great. And she sees an ad for Venice La Brea Florists, which had been a flower shop here since the 1920s. You know, all the celebrities went there because it's close to Hollywood and whatnot, and close to Beverly Hills. She walks in. They're not even hiring. It's just an ad. She takes the bus and goes over there and gives them the ad and thinks it's a hire me ad. It's a classified. And they're all, yeah, how can I help you? She's like, I need a job. And they're like, we're not hiring. She goes behind the counter, grabs a table, and using the scraps that are on the table and a vase makes this a beautiful arrangement that they've never seen before. Cause she was doing the Oriental design, right? That what they called. And the owner of the shop's like, what is that? I've never seen that. I need you to show my employees how to do that. And she's like, well, I need a job. So you're hired. So she started making these Oriental design arrangements, which just became the new wave back in the 80s. And she became so popular, they started asking her to go to trade shows to show people how to do these things. Well, she started saving up all her money because we lived pretty humbly back then. And she ended up buying her own flower shop in Long Beach. She did really well. She was always in conversation with the owners of the Venice La Brea Florist. And the owner said, hey, I'm retiring. I'm going to sell the shop. And I just think it'd be a great story if you wanted to buy it from me. So she did. Ended up being full circle. She goes back and buys a shop that gave her a chance. The employees there, they came from all walks of life. And if you're from the South LA area, you know that there's a certain culture and community there that maybe you know, they struggle a little bit more than the next. And my mom treated them like family. And this was something she brought from her Korean culture. So when lunch hour came, it wasn't like people went off and got lunch. She catered lunch every day. She would go out and say, what do you guys want? It could be, I don't care if it was a McDonald's or if it was at a nice restaurant. She would have it brought and they would eat family style. So she developed family. And that's one of the things I adopt. We have our roll call. What you guys call them roll call. We call them briefings. And my philosophy is briefings are the only time we may be with each other for an entire, during that entire shift, unless there's a big containment or something. But other than that, briefing is the only time we can kind of let our guard down, be in a safe place and not really worry about saying anything out of line in the community. So I'm like, this is our communion time. So I took my mom's example and I would always make sure we ate something during briefing. So when I had the first chance to be a patrol sergeant and have my own team, I said, I don't care if it's a box of donuts. Sometimes I bring in taquitos, tamales, whatever was available to me that I can get in bulk. That's what we would do. And it started developing a reputation that the patrol guys wanted to come to my team, even though it was on a less desirable shift because I had the low seniority. I made sure when we walked out of that door, it was on a high level. Because when you walk out of that door on a high level, that affects how you interact with the community on patrol. Other sergeants I came up with, we'd read the briefing book, we'd read wants. And hey, by the way, admin wants you to do this, this and that, because you guys do a crappy job of doing this. We'd walk out kind of with our heads hung low. And that's the kind of motivation we have for the day. So in a long way of answering your question, I had to set that up with my family to understand what makes me tick and what gives me my mindset for leadership. It's my parents. They were my first examples of leadership. They knew how to treat their people, because you're nothing. If they don't want to follow you, you're not a leader. So you have to make them want to follow you. And if you show them that you value who they are as people and that they're part of your tribe, they're your family, that's a really easy formula to win them over.
I think I have a better book recommendation or better author for you. The author I think that you should look into, who is literally my sensei, and you could start with his YouTube videos, is a guy named Seth Godin, G-O-D-I-N. Okay. I think anybody can learn from this guy. He's just my best friend who's a police lieutenant here in New Jersey called me the night we were talking. He goes, dude, I just can't stop listening and watching the Godin stuff. Just so, so much deeper of a thinker and comical. He's got like that, he's got a good comical feel to him. And I think that one you could watch is Leadership Versus Management, Seth Godin on YouTube. Dude, even today when you're fucking grabbing a sandwich and eating lunch, whatever it may be, I've probably watched that one 25 times. The other one that I've probably watched 85 times is Seth Godin Linchpin on YouTube. Oh, it's very good. But you're going to like, once you get into Godin and you start, you could even just toy around with his YouTube videos. Aaron, you got to reach out to me when you're done with it and let me know if I was right with that. I just know who you are. As you're talking, I'm like trying to fucking dissect, you know, like, how's he thinking? Where is he at? Like, see that. The Goggins book is a good read. I think it speaks to a certain person at a certain time in their life. No doubt, probably the most impactful audience he has is somebody who is struggling or needs that spark to get ignited. His first couple chapters in the auto book is amazing. Almost had me crying, to be quite honest with you, hearing how the life that he went through and how hard it was. It also motivated me to like, when I was listening to it while I was working out, I'm like, all right, fucking Goggins did it, right? Like you're don't be a lazy piece of shit, right? But Godin, man, you're gonna fucking love David. You're gonna love Seth Godin, I promise you.
Stuff like that makes me tick. I mean, you mentioned the first couple chapters of Goggins' book, and I even though I haven't read it yet, I'm familiar with his background. I knew like his dad was like a womanizer, owned like
he's like beat the fucking piss out of them.
Yeah. And you know, so he went through personal tragedy, and that's the reason why someone recommended his book to me. So yeah, I don't know if you know about my personal tragedy or not, but I know you're trying to dissect who I am as a person, but this one's going to really throw you off. So my dad committed suicide in 2013, and my mom was murdered in 2015.
Oh, okay.
So
I'm very sorry, dude. I meant to say before for your friend who was the chief and the other coworkers that were killed in the line of duty, I wanted to get into that. Maybe we could do it on the next podcast episode, but. For all these things, one blanketed, I'm very, very sorry. I am a man of compassion and empathy. And I don't wear it on my sleeve, but in my soul, I feel for you on those levels.
I, appreciate that. Yeah. And I think empathy is one of those hallmark characteristics of leadership that you cannot read in a book. You can't go out there and buy, you know, empathy. You have to live life. And so even though those things happened to me, I'm an only child, right? So I had to absorb all those things, carry all those things, go through my dad, you know, and in between that, when my dad died and I had to do his arrangements, my mom revealed to me that she had stage 3C ovarian cancer. So we battled that. She beat it. She went into remission only to get killed 2 months later. So in those 2 years, I think it would be enough to break anybody. And yeah, I had my times. I went through my little tantrums and whatnot, but you know what came out of that was what you see here. If you look at my stuff, my early social media stuff, it was very humorous, very comedic. I took myself less seriously, and then these experiences happened, and I just did. I could, that wasn't me anymore. I'm not saying I'm a darker version of myself, but I'm a more enlightened version of myself. And I know that people want out there that comedy, that slapstick stuff, there's a purpose for that. That's temporary, right? And the stuff I want to put out there now that I know once it's out there on cyberspace, it's out there forever. And that my kids, you know, they're older now, they're teenagers, and one's going to be an adult here in a year, less than a year. Jeez. You know, now that she has social media, I know that she's cognizant of the stuff that she sees I put out there. I want to make sure whatever I leave out there now is more going to leave more of a legacy and an impression on people than just that temporary laughter. I want to make sure that people know that when I put stuff out there, it's profound. It's going to give them some lessons. And I just want to be an example of that. So when I hear people say, man, I don't know what to do with myself. I got passed up for this promotion. I'm like, oh, that sucks. It does suck. Hey, but by the way, when my dad died and my mom died and this happened, I came out of it. And so if I can go through that, so can you. The point of all that is now that I'm starting to put that stuff out there is if I can get through what I went through and still be in the position that I'm in now, and you know, in the foreseeable future, I think I'm going to still continue in this success, that you can too. And I'm not anybody special. I didn't come with any kind of special talents or skills. I'm not 6'5", 250 pounds. But that's how I approach life. I approach life like I'm this supersized defensive and I can tackle anything that comes my way. And that's the attitude a lot of people need and develop. So that's what attracted me. My personal friends know that's what makes me tick. And that's what Goggins, like friends that have read Goggins' books, have told me about them. That's why I'm looking forward to that one.
Are you okay with talking about some of those incidents in your life, your father and your mother?
Yeah. So my parents divorced when I was 18. My mom assimilated in this country, you know, at the time, you know, the 80s and 90s, we're approaching that, that women independence thing, right? Where you don't need a man and you don't need to be that housewife. And my mom certainly wasn't. She was successful. She was a real estate developer. She had multiple businesses. She had real estate. And so she was becoming less dependent on my dad. And my dad, he had a video shop and then a HVAC company. And my dad had a very hard job. And he was even at 50 years old, was still crawling into attic spaces and, you know, very successful in what he did, but just two different approaches. My mom was more of the suit and tie type of person. And my dad was the blue collar guy. And I guess just over the years, it just kind of went that way. They split apart. And so they divorced when I was 18. My mom moved to Lakeland, Florida, where she had some properties. And my dad split to another part of Southern California. And I ended up moving in with my grandparents. They pretty much raised me anyway, because they were so busy running their businesses. I after school, went to my grandparents. And sometime after dinner, they would pick me up. So my grandparents were really the ones that raised me. And the question was asked, hey, do you want to move to Florida? Do you want to move where I'm down? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to stay with my grandparents. And I kind of grew up early. And I had a job. I had two part-time jobs when I was 18, so I could pay for college, which was miserable because I didn't want to pay for college. I didn't want to go to college, but that's just what I thought I had to do. And by the way, to some of your parents out there listening, don't force your kids to go to college after high school. It's a waste of money. And if you are one of those parents that do, make them go to junior college. Go the cheap route, because you're paying for a 4-year college for those first 2 years, you'll see is a quick waste of money, because they change their majors 100 times. They don't know what they want to do at 18. You got to let them live a little bit of life. figure out what they want to do. And then if they want to go to college to attain that degree that helps them with their career, let them do that. And that's coming from a college professor. My kids, I'm going to tell them to live life a year or two, go to a mission, get a job or whatever. If you're one of those guys that can get a scholarship, that's different, but don't start your life out in debt and don't take advantage of the scholarship unless you know what you're doing. Because I went to college the first time and ended up dropping out because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'm like, why am I paying for this? So, hey, long, fast forward a few years. I'm on my own. I'm doing my own thing. I knew I wanted to be a cop. I was going to go to the military. I was going to be a third generation Army guy, like my dad and my grandfather. And they made me promise to go to college first so that I'd be an officer and not just an enlisted guy that was going to take orders from a 20-year-old officer. They wanted me to have a better career in the Army. So that was kind of their demise, because when I was walking through the quad one day at Cal State LA, I get hit up by a recruiter from the sheriff's department and he said, hey, you can serve your community and make this paycheck right here. And I was like, all right, that's what I'm doing. Cause I was selling ladies' shoes. I was folding socks and I'm like, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Carrying guns and chasing bad guys is what I wanted to do. And the rest is history. I was hooked. I mean, I was way in over my head. There was no reason why they should have given this 22-year-old guy a gun and a badge and the authority to arrest people. So I did, you know, the first 5 years of my career, I did a lot of growing up, made a lot of mistakes. And that's where I quickly learned that a guy my size doesn't get to bark orders at a 6'7" quote. you learn communication skills, right? Verbal judo. I hate that term, but that's the one.
Imagine if they would have just taught you that in the academy. Imagine if they would have spent fucking, I don't know, an hour on like, hey, you know, being a dick's not going to work. Just so you guys know. Right. Yeah. Like nobody's like, you're going to get a lot further by being polite and kind and showing mutual respect. Yeah. Right.
The point, they have their own code, respect code. Right. And the sooner you develop that understanding, then the easier your career will be. Cause I should have been in way more scraps in my career than I gotten in. And cause I worked at Men's Central Jail for 5 years. I mean, you're in the mix, right? There's nothing that separates you from the inmate. You get locked into a day room, wall-to-wall inmates, and there's a desk and it may be a sting ball grenade in the drawer. And that's you. You don't carry weapons in there. You carry a pepper spray and a flashlight. So yeah, I should have been way more scraps, but I think I learned how to display to the inmates that I wasn't a threat per se, but you know, the real threat was going to come 30 seconds after I called for help. So, it worked out. Fast forward, 2013, I'm in a training class, in-house training class. It's our refresher. I don't know if you guys have them, but every couple of years we got to do our perishable skills training, and it was first aid CPR. My grandmother, you know, I talked to my grandparents, you know, call me a shitty grandchild, but you know, birthdays, holidays, that's when I talk to them. So she calls me and I'm like, something must be up. And she calls me and says, you need to come to your dad's house right now. Just like that. Like, not really exigent, but more angry. I'm like, okay. I'm like, can it wait? I'm in a training class. She's all, no, right now. And she hangs up. So I'm like, something's up. So they're 5 miles away. I go over there. I see FD pull up. I see some units in the front, and I go to my dad's room, and yeah, he's hanging. He hung himself. And so he'd always battled some demons, and it makes a lot of sense now as a cop, but you know, I don't know if you remember the first time you ever smoked or smelled weed. Smoked weed. I remember when I started as a teenager being exposed to weed, I'm like, you know, the smell is familiar to me. Well, my dad grew up smoking weed. He, you know, it's something that he did, and it was around the house. I remember he had a keychain that was a small copper pipe, and I would pick that up and I'd smell this distinct smell of burnt leaves. And so then that progressed into other stuff. They call it a gateway drug for a reason. So my dad had a coke dependency in the 80s, and that turned to a meth thing. And so that was one of the things that led to my parents splitting up anyway as well. So yeah, my dad he was clean for a while. And when I finally had kids, it was like a new lease. I said, you're not going to be anywhere near my family unless you clean up your act. And I guess he did. But right around 2013, my mom and dad were starting to talk again. And I think my mom didn't have any preconceived notions of getting back with my dad ever, but But when she saw how, you know, I had kids and she wanted my kids to have a steady set of grandparents, encouraged her to kind of give my dad another chance. And he'd been clean for a few years. So my dad's saying, hey, this is an opportunity for me to get back with my mom, my wife, or his wife. And when that didn't work out, that really sent my dad down another spiral. And he started dabbling again, I think, because first thing I did was after you know the coroner pulled him away, or the mortuary pulled him away, I looked around his room and I was doing the cop thing. And sure enough, I find a glass tile and there's some residue on there. And so my dad had a bad trip probably because he didn't leave a note or anything like that. And maybe he was just spiraled into depression. So it's weird. I really never depended on my dad as an adult. But I felt like when he was gone, I kind of lost that part of my safety net because I could still go to him, you know, ask dad stuff. I said, Dad, I know I was a shitty kid growing up, but I have one of my own. My older boy is the reincarnation of me, and I was a handful. So he's kind of like my curse right now. And I can cut him off ahead of time because I know where he's headed. So he was that guy I could go to get that kind of advice. And so, you know, our worlds are rocked. My mom just tells me, hey, I didn't want to tell you, but I have ovarian cancer and I've been battling that. So I'm like, crap. So like, give me some more bad news, right? So I say we beat it, but she beat it, right? She, against all odds, she beats this thing. She meets this guy, his name is Peter Hong. He was a really nice guy. He was my mom's golf coach from, back in the day. And, they developed a friendship again. It became romantic. And then, Christmas 2014, he proposes to her and, she says yes. So, and mind you, this entire time people are trying to date my mom because she's an attractive woman. And she had money. And so she could see right through that with some of these guys. And one of these guys, his name was Jay, romanticized my mom. And, you know, he was a scam artist basically. So my mom kicked him to the curb, but she's one of those ladies that, just has a big heart. He's like, hey, you caught me up. I need a place to live. So she owned a senior, mobile home in a trailer park in Oceanside, California, which is close to Escondido. And she says, hey, this is vacant. You can live here for a couple months until you get back on your feet, but I need you out of here. A couple months later, she gets proposed to. She meets Peter. Peter's like, hey, you need to cut off all ties with this guy. So she leaves his house in Huntington Beach and says, hey, I don't want you to come with me because I know you're going to start something with this dude. He's leaving my house today, and he's going to meet me at the front porch and give me the keys. I can do this myself. I'm a big girl. And so from Huntington Beach to Oceanside, maybe a 2-hour drive, she goes down there to pick up the keys, and Peter's just like, okay with it. You know, like, hey, I'll start dinner. She'll be back by dinner time. And, right about 9 o'clock in the evening, I get a phone call from, Ben, my chief that died. He was the watch commander at the time. And Ben grew up at my house. My house was the hangout house, after school. So he had a relationship with my mom and he was just bawling. I was like, what's going on? And, he's like, I don't know how to tell you this. Your mom's dead. I'm like, what are you talking about? Because you just need to call Oceanside police right now. And so I get off the phone with him and I call, and the detective was very, straight to the point. And as a matter of fact, and she says, I don't know how to tell you this, but your mom was murdered. Sorry to tell you how it happened. And can you get down here? So yeah, we get down there. And long story short, this guy was upset and said that if he couldn't have my mom, no one else could. So he used the guise of giving my mom the keys to have an opportunity to meet with her. They get to the front porch. He basically drags her in the house, straps her to the chair, and shoots her in the head. And this coward, he tried to off himself and missed. You can see one area where it's in the separate part of the house. He ends up shooting into the ceiling. And then you can see a glancing wound to this. There's a glancing wound to the side of his head. And then he ends up doing the job. He does it the right way and offs himself. So yeah, there was never any vindication on my part. No, no way to see justice happen. And man, it took me a long time to just be able to talk about this. I think it was a couple of years ago that I first went public with it, but I felt like people needed to hear it, because I have, if you follow me for any amount of time, you know that I'm no angel, but I have a tremendous amount of faith, because I know that if it wasn't for my belief in God, that I wouldn't be here today. But, you know, I easily can say that I could have been in depression. I could have been really destructive to my family, but I didn't. I said, I really had a tremendous belief that all this is happening for a reason. We may not understand these reasons, and as shitty as it is to have gone through, I got to have faith that it's all part of God's plan at the end of the day. And whether it's because I talk about it and it might help somebody else, if that saves somebody else, then maybe that's my reason. I don't know. I still don't know what the reason is, but I can tell you right now, I'm at peace with everything. The way it happened was crappy, but I'm living my life today for my family. And, you know, in the weird way, my life's been enriched and blessed ever since, because, you know, having this as my testimony is like having a constant rounds of ammunition in your back pocket. Cause it really, the looks on people's faces when they tell you, hey man, I'm having a shitty time, I'm going through this personally, I'm like, that's great. Let me tell you what I went through and that it's going to be okay. To be able to say that and that carry more gravity and weight than what the other person goes through, that changes their perspective 100%.
How did you find peace?
Like I said earlier, I went through with my family, I want to be the guy that's always in control. My kids know I'm a very controlled. I want to be the best dad and father I can be. So they've never seen the part of me that lets loose at parties and stuff like that, right? At weddings. And, you know, and if you look at my bar, you would think, man, this guy likes to drink. I am a connoisseur of whiskeys and bourbons. I like my distilled stuff. But I never get out of control. And maybe that's because I've seen what my dad went through. First time I ever got drunk in front of my wife was right after my mom died. And to my wife's credit, she's like, I just knew you had to have that. I just knew I needed to let you do that. And she had to carry me upstairs. That's how bad it was. And you know, so I had my moment where I let myself do something I said I'd never do in front of my family. And that really was sobering to me. The next morning, my wife was telling me what I was saying, what I was doing. It was a complete, you know, blackout for me. And, but I knew my time to sulk was over. I needed to get through it and be an example. Like that. My kids didn't even know. They knew she died, but they knew they didn't know how. I think my oldest daughter is the only one that's aware of it now. But, I shielded them from it. Maybe part of it was embarrassment and shame, but the other thing was, it's hard for me to talk about. You still want to talk about it. So I suppressed it for a long time. And I didn't really find that I was going to move forward until I did. And so when I started talking about it, I had this shirt sponsor of mine, they're called Dangerous But Good at the time. They wanted to hear my testimonial, and they asked me if I would put it on video, and I did. And that's really when the therapy started. I put it out there, got a lot of weight off my shoulders, but the messages I got from people, a lot of them were messages for encouragement, but a lot of them were messages from people like, oh my gosh. And the ones that really stuck out to me are the ones that were like, I was ready to divorce my wife. Like, I was going to leave my kids. I was going to go into self-destruction mode. And watching what you said and seeing how there's a light at the end of the tunnel really changed my perspective. And I'm like, man, I was really able to help people. So I'd have conversations on the side with these people. Total strangers. And I was never a trained therapist or anything like that, but just hearing them out and letting them know that it's going to be okay. My formula right there, just listening to them and telling them that it's going to be okay, really made an impact on these people. And it became therapeutic to me. And so am I out of it? I don't know, man, maybe it's going to manifest itself in an unhealthy way later on. But so far it's been, it'll be 8 years, this in January, that the incident happened with my mom. And I still feel like I'm pretty stable and put together. So we'll see.
Unfortunately, I'm privy to trauma. And you know, I'm not going to sit here and say it's my own or anybody else's, but I am privy to it. And one thing I do want to forewarn you about is you don't want this push down suppressed trauma to erupt. My suggestion as a friend, somebody who does care about you, and I hope I'm fucking praying you make it on January 20th to the class. I really, and that's on me. You don't got to pay for that shit, dude. Like I want you to just come and hang out and check it out. And like, we'll have Chipotle or something. I don't fucking know. In-N-Out. Sorry. In-N-Out. I'm going to In-N-Out. Yeah. We're going to In-N-Out. Sorry, dude. Just that's where I'm going. We don't have it over here. And I wake up some nights in cold sweats thinking about it. I you know, this is from one person to another, two men who were completely secure with themselves. And I would accept it from you if you said it to me. I really would put some thought into trying to get to managing some of that stuff, because when it erupts, dude, you might never be the same person ever again in your life. And if you like who you are, and believe me, I've seen trauma cases where people, and I'm not a therapist, I'm just happen to get thrown into the mix where, you know, it was like, if it had been managed, it could have been different. So you don't want that, especially if you love your wife and your kids, and you would cherish those relationships. You know, I go to therapy to be a better person, right? I'm like fact checking my behavior because I want all my relationships to be very, very thoughtful. So I'll sit here and tell you, I go to therapy once a week. And you know what, dude? My therapist respects me. She doesn't talk to me like I'm a fucking idiot. But I'm like, you know, what's your thoughts on this? How do I approach a situation like this? You've been a therapist for 31 years. I know I'm not the only cop that goes there.
That's very real. And I mean, cut you off, but just while it's fresh in my head, we had in June, we had our two officers go, and that's the first time we ever had therapists come to our department, peer counselors. And so that was the first time I ever talked to one. But yeah, I did have my one-on-ones with a therapist. And so, yeah, just a couple of weeks ago, I was actually talking to some friends about maybe I should do this because I feel like I'm in a good place, but I know you never know what's going to make
you. Dude, I'm telling you. I 2 months ago, I'm like, you know what? I'm good. Da-da-da. Like literally, I kind of like played her. She didn't like know it. I'm like, hey, my fucking schedule's tight. You know who I am and what I do and da-da-da. Right. And then I was like, something happened. And I was like, hey, I'll be there on Tuesday, or just so you know, something came up, I'm free now. Man, I said to myself, this could be a lifetime thing, especially, you know, when you go through these very difficult moments. I say it because I also want to tell you that the first therapist I got did nothing for me. And I wrote that therapist an email after trying her for 6 or 7 weeks. I said, you know, I don't find this to be resolving anything. I don't think you're addressing issues that I'm trying to address. I understand why you're having a difficult time addressing some of those issues. You don't know other things. And then I went to another one and I was like, well, this is great, right? This is, so if you find one, don't get dissuaded by it. Keep therapist shopping, give them a little bit of time. But dude, I don't want to see anybody think they're fine. And again, maybe you are, but like, we just had a guy in last week from California on the podcast who his father was killed in the line of duty. And you could listen to that episode. I think it's episode 763 or 764. And he had a profound moment here on this show where he was like, fuck, I didn't think about that. I'm like, yeah, dude, I'm not doing it to make you feel bad, or I just don't want to see your family suffer because we think we're okay. Just like, I don't want to see my family suffer because I think I'm okay. So I go and manage it. And you know,
I'm not too proud to admit that, you know, I did have that conversation with some close friends of mine about, you know, I really do fear that someday this animal's going to pop out. I have different, I think it's important if you're listening and you don't have an outlet, I don't care if it's watercolors on the lake. I do personally, for me, I do jujitsu, and I only did it for the last year and a half. And I wish I had discovered this 10 years ago, because this is it's a healthy outlet. I let some aggression. By the time I get home, coupled with my hour and a half commute, I'm just a different person than when I was at work. I'm frenetic and whatnot. Jiu-jitsu happens after work. I have my commute. I come home. I'm this tamed beast. So,
dude, I meditate typically twice a day. I work out a lot. But it doesn't mean that I wasn't aware of now where I was like, wow, I was doing some weird shit. And it's really interesting when you sit with somebody and you're like, we're doing this, this, and this. And I'm like, how the fuck did you know that? They're like, well, that's a typical response when somebody's in grief. And I'm like, oh, I was doing weird shit like that. Now that you say it, I look at it, I'm like, well, that was fucking weird, huh? I feel like it's not your fault. Like when you submit that's the human brain and this is why we're trained. We know what to expect, what to see. And look, here's a book. And this is what you're going to be going through. Just like when you hear these guys come back from these wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and they'll tell them, like, you have PTSD. There's nothing you can fucking do. So here's what you can expect is going to happen. Let it just submit that it's there, and then we can manage it. So, sure. Dude, you know, listen, from the bottom of my heart, you know, I love you, and I want you to acknowledge that, like, that's the stuff you saw, the things you went through, none of that's normal. And we just have to, you know, like, just, I'm sure you know that already, and I don't want to be insulting your intelligence, but we had a guy on recently, again, same thing, got shot in the face in South Carolina or North Carolina. Sorry if I said it wrong, but somewhere on the East Coast in the South where they have heavy accents. I think it's South Carolina. And on the podcast, he's like, yeah, I know. I think I'm good. So I called him afterwards. I'm like, listen, dude, you got to go see somebody. Like, you got shot in the fucking face. And, you know, recently he followed up. He's like, hey, man, we're seeing somebody, me and the wife. And because it's not even about us anymore. It's about making sure we're the best fathers we can be, the best husbands we can be, the best leaders we can be, the best friends we can be. And yeah, I think we all get put through this shit, especially a guy like you, especially a guy like me, because people turn to us and say, like, hey, I'm going through something. And now I can say, I know what it is. I had to go through it to understand it, just like you did. And that's the big why that it happened to me. And I have some more questions on that too for you, but, you know, and I don't say this to you here publicly just for you, I'm saying it with purpose, because I know somebody's listening. We have a very big following and they're saying to myself, fuck, that's me. Right. Cause I get those messages like, dude, that was me. Right. So I hope that that really, you know, just even to find out, like, if somebody's like, nah, you're fucking good, go back to fucking your life.
Yeah. Cool. Anything, right. If anybody listening is in the same position I am, I can tell you right now, I'm going through what you're going through. We're fixers. We're like, we got this. But yeah, lately, especially with my, one of my best friends for 30 years going, yeah, it really tugged at me a little harder this time. When the other two went, I mean, that was very, very difficult. Don't get me wrong, but compound everything on top of that with.
Oh yeah, brother. I'm going to sit here and tell you right now, having the most difficult 18 to 20 months of my life. And you would have never looked at our organization. And that doesn't mean that Street Cop's going anywhere. Street Cop's doing great, right? Like, I'm talking about literally sit around here laughing, like, is the Lord done yet? Because, like, I, you know, this is round 14, fucking Mickey's yelling, stay down. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm not the fucking guy. Like, you're never going to beat my spirit. But if you actually listen to the Goggins book or read it, whatever it may be, you'll actually find out that he's actually a very sentimental guy, very callous brain. But he speaks about this stuff and how important it is to address things like this and what his faults were for not doing that and not dealing with it appropriately, you know?
Yeah, I didn't know. We talked about this before the show that, you know, what our topic was going to be. And we said, hey, let's just run with it and see what happens. And I'm glad it developed into what it is now, because I want there to be some meaning behind these episodes. And for me, just after kind of recapping what's been going on here in this conversation, I think your listeners can find that I'm a guy that they can relate to. And I'm a guy that's not impervious to getting into personal trauma himself. And I'm also not a guy that's beneath maybe going to seek some help. So,
it's got to be an example set, right? These are the guys that you look up to. Like, we're sitting here telling you with all vulnerability, like, say what you like, you can pretend whatever. Like, we're smart, we're intelligent, and we're acknowledging that, like, sometimes you just got to make these decisions to do things. I do have a question, because people do look at you, and I find this to be a very interesting question, although very basic, but I think you're going to answer it well. I imagine that you think your world is falling apart, that you can't figure out why this is happening to you. Maybe the life is being sucked out of you. Everything that you loved, essentially, in some sense, or some of the most major things that you loved, is now gone, feeling with the emptiness maybe of what that's left you feeling like. Where did you go to mentally, or what did you tell yourself to get through the most difficult times of your life, and especially most recently?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm a lucky guy. My wife, I should I'm lucky. I mean, I there's no reason why a guy like me deserves a wife like her, because if you knew who I was one of the captains of the football team all 4 years. I was a popular guy. I was on the prom court, whatnot. In college, in the 2 years I was in college, I was in the fraternity. And, you know, I probably should have been a dad before I was 20 years old. I probably should have had some diseases. I lived life very carelessly, right? And I was very lucky. And then when you, at a certain point, you look back and go, I shouldn't be here in the position that I'm at. And then here's one incident I'll give you. I was in the process, stupid kid. I was in the process of becoming a sheriff's deputy. I had the application process going. I'm 20 years old. The fraternity house is about 5 exits from my house. I was drinking. I was smoking some weed. I probably shouldn't have been driving. Sure enough, 1 mile before the exit, I'm supposed to exit, I get pulled over by the CHP. It was notorious. I mean, they'd write their own mother's tickets, right? And I get pulled over, and what do they smell? An odor of an alcoholic beverage emitting from my vehicle. And this is how it played out. He's like, have you been drinking? I'm like, yeah, you know, I had some drinks, but I waited till I was sober enough to drive. I think we're going to have to pull you out of the car and give you a field sobriety test, which I probably would have failed. I mean, even if they just checked the nystagmus, I would have failed. You could tell one of them was a trainee and one of them was an FTO. And the FTO goes, you know why I know he's okay? Why? Asian people turn bright red when they drink. I don't know if you knew this or not. Asian people,
true?
They're missing most Asian people are missing an enzyme in their stomach, that same enzyme that makes them lactose intolerant. There's this enzyme that makes the minute alcohol touches your lips, you turn bright red. And that's a telltale giveaway for Asian people who drink. I don't know if it's because I came from a long line of drinkers, but we don't turn red in my family. And it's a very rare thing. And I didn't turn red. I wasn't red. And the FDA, save yourself from trouble. Here's a lesson, kid. Asians turn bright red. He's not red. We're wasting our time. Let's go. And looked at my license and realized it was down the street. Anyway, so can you imagine though, if I had gotten a DUI and, or if I was one of those guys that turned red, like all my Asian friends do, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now. I wouldn't be a cop. I tell you that much. But all these things that against all odds, and man, I've seen some people with tremendous amount of credibility that couldn't become a cop for whatever reason. Against all odds, I was put in a position to not only be a cop, but be put into a leadership role and have all these opportunities. So I really feel like in these fortuitous moments, God was there. God had to have a hand in all this. And as shitty as a kid as I was, as stupid as a guy I was through college and all that stuff, I had a tremendous faith. I knew all these things happened in my life because of God. And I don't know, I used to call them coincidences happened, where I'm like, the only thing I could think of is God bailed me out. And it's not, it's providence. At the end of the day, it's providence. It's what the Bible calls it. It's like, you are destined to be somewhere. God has all your book already pre-written. You're now fulfilling the chapters of this book that's pre-written for you, your destiny. And that's called providence. And so I feel like I'm here, you know, I don't know why people follow me on social media, but they do for a reason. I don't know why I got this promotion to sergeant, but they gave it to me for a reason. I don't know why any of this stuff is happening to me. So other than faith. So to answer your question, how did I get through this? I have to believe that the good moments happen because of God, and even the bad moments happen because of God. And this is all part of my book. And I'm just waiting to live out the chapters and see how it ends. But I really do feel like the purpose is greater than me, and greater than me to be selfish, to sulk in it. I have to move on and be there for other people. That's just who I am. I've always been there for other people. I'm never going to do anything out of selfishness and in terms of removing myself from a position to where I'm going to be there for others, or I'm not going to make other people upset because of something I did. So yeah, faith at the end of the day.
Maybe it's time to do something for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I mean, you know,
no, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just take a breather for a second. There's a saying I love. It's called being selfish to be selfless.
Yeah, no, I do. And you know, jiu-jitsu is a perfect example of that. It takes a tremendous amount of time. It's an hour and a half a day. And that's time I could be at home an hour and a half earlier. I don't get home till 9 o'clock. Kids are in bed. I take a shower. My wife and I talk in bed and then I go to sleep and I wake up at 3 a.m. I spend more time away from the house than I do at home. And, you know, but at the same time, my wife completely understands why I need jiu-jitsu right now. I work a stressful position and I need that outlet. And really it's for me, I like beating up on people. So, but yeah, I know the mental game needs to be, in check. And you know, as we're talking here, I'm like, yeah, maybe this is a push I need, to go talk to someone.
Oh man, this is so good for me. Like, because dude, like same thing, right? Like what if I didn't go through what I went through? Right. Would I be saying this to you now? So is we've reversed roles. You're not used to being that guy who's saying what you just said, right? And I was never the guy who understood any of this stuff either until I sat down and talked with hundreds of people who went through traumatic things and then experienced it for myself at significant levels. And that's the whole purpose, dude.
Things happen for a reason, right?
So I'm glad you said yes to coming onto the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point I'm getting at. It's like, you know, I value my weekend time. As a matter of fact, we're supposed to go to Universal Studios today because my days off are my days off. I don't do any side projects or anything like that. So if I can do it all during my four work days, then I do that. But this one, I'm like, you know, this was not, I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I get asked to be on podcasts a lot. And I'm like, yeah, no, I don't think I'm going to do this one. I don't have time, or this isn't, it's the return of investment isn't good for me. But this one, I mean, this one was like, hey, I respect the page. I respect you. I'm like, yeah, this would be a good conversation to have. So let's do it. And never thought in a million years that this is what we'd be talking about. I'm pretty private about that stuff, but here we are talking about it and it's good. It's everything happens for a reason.
I'm so happy and proud of you and that you're having this profound moment. It's fucking awesome, dude. And I say that from one bro to another, you know what I mean? Like, I really do mean that. And I really do hope that we get to meet each other in real life. And
yeah, I think
January, dude, you're a fucking boss. It's a Friday, right? Yeah. Just get a training day. Tell him, walk upstairs. I need a training day. It'll be good. You'll enjoy it. It'll be well worth it. And again, I know that when you come in there, you know, we'll be going over a lot of stuff that I'm sure you probably already know, but there'll be some real diamonds in there. And if anything, you'll be able to take stuff back and disseminate it out to your men and women under you. And just to recap a little bit, you know, you said earlier that it was the faith that kept you going. So I'm guessing over and over again, you must repeat it to yourself that this is God's plan. This is God's way. For me, I always tell people like, look, man, it's one foot in front of the other, right? Like every minute that you're not groveling, you're trying to take that step forward, even their baby steps, it counts. Cause then all of a sudden you look behind and you're out of it. You're out of the surf. You're looking back on how the fuck did I get out of that? Right. How did I get out of that? And then guess what? When that same surf comes along again in your life, you're used to it. It just becomes this comfort factor. So if rough seas scare people, I'm not saying I like being here. I'm just saying I'm not fucking panicked being here because it's not my first journey into the fucking rough waters. And I know one thing is just like the last eight times in the past few years that I've been in these rough waters, they calm at some point. You get to breathe. And then all of a sudden something great happens. And, you know, you just got to believe that, hey, life is worth living. Nobody gets a free pass. The things that happened to you in the past 10 years of your life, or 14 years of your life, whatever it may be, they're horrible, dude. Nobody's discounting that at all. But one thing I'm learning in my therapy now is like painting this, I forgot what she called it, but like it's something called a narrative. So it's about what it was, what it is, and what it's going to be. Right. So like what we do is we stay stuck in one spot. And one of the biggest things you can do is to maybe see what it's going to be in the future and why the things happened and acknowledge like, for example, the great times your mother and father had with you and all those great things and the reasons you loved them the most, and how unfortunate it was for the circumstances that you explained earlier. But, you know, recognizing that, and I'm not probably not the qualified person to do this, but like, what does the future look like now? Knowing, you know, it's just, it's this whole really cool thing. And I was like, this is real. And I told her this literally last Wednesday. I'm like, or this week, I was like, it's really good. I think I'm already doing some of that, but that's good. I'm going to really put thought into that. She's like, well, you're like my star student. So I know that anything I tell you, you take and you fucking really, she's like, my prognosis for you is always high because you, I say things to you. You literally come back. I know you process stuff over a few days. And the progress for me is very rewarding because I can say this to other people till I'm blue in the fucking face. They're not hearing it. They don't want to hear it. And you're just very vulnerable, very opening to listening to this stuff. And I said, you know, I have an intention of living the best life I possibly can. And I'm always on the game of improving myself. And if this is part of it, I'm not here to hide it. You know, I want people to know about it. Just like when you say to me, hey, how's the business? Like, how do you build a business? Like, sit down. I'd love to share it with you. I want you to be successful too. I want you to have things that you never thought you'd have. I want you to have that comfort that I have. I want you to know all about it. And sometimes people say, well, kind of, you know, I'll get the wrong crowd. They're like, you know, you went a little farther. Well, I'm just excited about it. It's not a bragging thing. I want you to know that even if you're in a bad spot, anything's possible. And, you know, for me, it's like just holding on to that hope of like, things are going to get better. Right? Yeah. You're going to find out this blessing in disguise soon enough. Absolutely. Guys who get significantly injured in the line of duty, they're like, why did this happen to me? I'm like, because next week you're going to be shot in the fucking face. And when you meet the Lord and he says to you, the reason I had to have you removed from that job, the reason you got fired, the reason why it was unfair is because next week you're going to die and I needed you to be the father to your children. Yeah. You know, what if we told you that story? What if we said, hey, this happened because you would have died next week? You would say, well, I'm glad it happened this way.
Perspective is everything.
You got to have thoughts. You know, you got to think about it like that. Anyway, listen, dude, this is awesome. Right? This is all like we are. Aram, don't fucking kid yourself. You and I are very similar. I know we look alike. People probably mistaken us for twins. No question about it. I probably turn red when I fucking drink. That's probably the only difference we have when you see us physically. I appreciate you so much, dude. And I'm proud to know you. I've seen your stuff. And I'm like, man, I'm just thankful there's another dude out there who's on the same team we're on and believes in the same things that we believe in and is unafraid. And for that, I want to acknowledge you, dude. It takes a lot of bravery to show up. And I'm sure you endure the criticism. We're all familiar with it. And I hope that I have a friendship that lasts a lifetime with you.
I appreciate it. That means a lot coming from you. I respect you immensely. And this was just the icing on the cake. It solidified everything I thought about you, the person. So for you, someone I respect immensely, to tell me those things means a whole lot. So, and I know we have a lot more to talk about. So I hope you bring back on one day. And
yeah. Oh, dude, no, like, ASAP fucking Rocky, dude. Like, we're going to have Frankie reach out to you and get this thing just scheduled again. We definitely have a lot of unfinished business. And dude, I really, you know, listen, if you can't make it on the 20th, it's not a big deal. But once we cut the thing on this, I'll give you my cell phone number and anything you need, dude. And I think people are, it's so funny. I appreciate you acknowledging that, like, I'm showing up and being the person you thought I was. When we had our conference last year, a lot of my staff was coming back saying like, wow, Dennis is so nice. He's such a good dude. And I was like, where did they think I wasn't? And I'm like, maybe the perception is at times because of my emotional speeches and the, you know, calling out of the things that I see that are wrong. They get a perspective that maybe I'm not, but the most humbling thing is that this year on my birthday, which was very strange, a lot of people wrote very, very nice things about me and wrote to me. And actually, even the staff here made a video that is mostly embarrassing. I don't know if you saw it. You could check my Instagram out. You'll see it. But at the end, they wrote, we love you, Den. That means a lot to me because I put a lot of work in to get that back. I really, really try to show them a lot of love from my heart and my soul. And my job is to be a great person. And it's so interesting how people think about you when you really focus and put energy and effort into being a great person. That's how your legacy is built. That's how people recognize who you are and will follow you and be a leader or follow you and allow you to influence them. So All right, bro. Listen, appreciate you being here. Plug your shit, by the way, before we wrap this up. Instagram, anything you got, your Facebook, plug it, man. That's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, most people know me because of the podcast, the 911 Strong podcast. It's on all the platforms, Spotify, Apple, whatever. You can find all me on all the socials at 911 Strong. And if you're one of the few people that still have regular TV, a regular panelist on a show called iCrime with Elizabeth Vargas, it's syndicated. So it's going to be on different networks, depending on where you are. In California, it's on our local Fox network, but it's cool. It's a cool show. It's our first season, and we basically break down crime videos that happen that get caught on cell phone video. And the host is Elizabeth Vargas. She's an accomplished journalist. She's from the ABC News thing, and she did the reboot of America's Most Wanted. Really nice lady. But yeah, I mean, good things are happening, and I'm not putting myself out there to be a TV star or anything like that. But these opportunities come, and I'm blessed to be in a position where I can pick and choose which ones work for my situation right now. And that's a project I'm really most excited about right now. So, yeah, but I want to thank you guys for having me on. I'm looking at the time right now. It's almost been 2 hours. It was the quickest 2 hour conversation I've had in a long time. So thank you.
Yeah, me too, dude. And thank you for doing great things for the world.
I appreciate you.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.